on, Ramesh. Bring your guitar. I'm going to sing to you. You can have to suffer through this. This was the genesis of this song was an interesting one. Somebody had been a member of Ananda for quite a few years, and he never paid any of the dues that everybody pays to help keep the community going, and I let him do it. And after 12 years, we got a new general manager who decided that was time we stopped. So he called this man in and said to him that really it's doesn't seem right that we should let you stay here without paying anything, and you've spent your whole time criticizing us. And this man said, well, it seems to me it's good for the community to have a gadfly. And general manager said, well, yes, maybe it's good for the community, but is it good for you? And he said, I think from now on we're going to have to say either pay your normal dues, which are very light, or don't stay here any longer. So he left. And then he came and talked to me. He spent a whole hour telling me all the things that were wrong with me and my character and the fact that I was a complete failure in life and would accomplish nothing, and went on and on like this. And I just listened calmly and didn't say anything and thanked him. But afterwards, I wrote this song sort of to get it out of my system. A moving song to me, and that's why I faltered a little bit on the last notes. Okay, well, let's begin our talk today, and thank you. Today I'm going to read two passages because they say the same thing. This is from a book that I put together called Conversations with Yogananda, and he had me in his interview room, for example, when he had guests, or I would write down, he told me to write down his words. And I remember when he'd been working on the Bhagavad Gita, and Out of the Desert, and it was the most wonderful book I'd ever heard in my life, really. It was so deep, so practical, so full of wisdom. And he told me then to write down what I'm saying, not in my commentaries, but as we walked around the compound. And sometimes he would almost falter. I'd have to hold him to make sure he didn't fall. I remember one time he said, I'm in so many bodies, it's hard to remember which body to keep moving. But it was really a thrill to be with him, and to write his words down was it was wonderful. Also, he gave me the blessing to be able to remember his words, even when he didn't speak English. I remember this one time he sang a song in Bengali, which I didn't know, but I recorded it in my mind. And when I went to India about 8 years later, I found that that was correct Bengali the way I'd remembered it. Mukti dete pari, mukti dete pari, mukti dete pari, bhakti dete pari koi. I can give you, the Divine Mother singing to the devotee, O devotee, I can give you salvation, but don't ask my love and devotion, because when I give that away, I give everything away. Which is, of course, a way of saying, ask for my love, because that's the only thing that matters. We should pray to God for his love. Nothing else is important. And so anyway, I wrote these things down and they've filled this volume, but I've written many more in the New Path. I've written lots and lots of things, maybe 400. In the Essence of Self-Realization, I've written many more. And sometimes even now I keep remembering ones that I haven't written before. But I tell you, living with him was the most thrilling experience I can possibly imagine. It wasn't always easy, because he certainly helped us to improve ourselves by getting rid of our faults. But he always did it lovingly, in the sense that there was, you could feel, I would look into his eyes and I would see there was nothing but deep compassion there. There was no sense of ego, no sense of condescension. One of the things that impressed me very much about him was his utter respect for everyone. He accepted people as they were, those who came to him for training, those who came to him to help get his help to escape from the clutches of Maya, of delusion. Naturally, he had to help them. He couldn't mince words with them, but otherwise he was completely open. I remember this one time, I think I told you this story before, but it's well worth repeating anyway. We went to a show. There was a man from India who was a boxer, and he decided he wanted to do a dance. He was fine boxing in the ring, but as a dancer, he was not exactly your ideal. And he played the part of a hunter chasing a deer, and he was lumbering about the stage, and the orchestra got out of sync with him, or more probably the opposite. Anyway, he stopped the orchestra, came down to the footlights, and apologized for the orchestra for the way they were playing. And then every time he went back, he'd like this to the orchestra. Finally, after God knows how long, the deer died. He managed to shoot the deer, and it went agonizing all over the stage until finally it collapsed, and there was that little timid applause, thinking, God, it's over. When, no, we'd forgotten he was the hunter, too. And he jumped to his feet and put the deer around his neck and was lumbering about. And finally, we saw somebody in the orchestra go like this to the sidelines, and the curtain came down. And you saw him turn like this, and the next scene was these feet as he marched across to give them a piece of his mind. Master and I were sitting side by side, and Master laughed so hard that the tears were coming down his cheeks. But afterwards, when this man complained bitterly at the way he'd been treated, Master didn't show the laughter. He had respect for him. He knew where he was coming from. He was center everywhere, circumference nowhere. And whereas it was very funny from one point of view, from this poor fellow's point of view, it was not. Master understood that point of view, too. And then afterwards, there was a man from India. He wasn't from Bengal. And he was sort of overfamiliar, and he was throwing his arms around Master and greeting him like old drinking buddies. And this Bengali said to Master something in an undertone about what an odd figure he was cutting. The Master said, don't. He just had respect for everybody. He accepted them as they were. There was this one time that Master entered a hotel lobby, and this man came over, and I don't know how he got the idea, but he said to Master in his drunken sort of stupor of his, he said, "Hello, Lord Jesus Christ." And he must have recognized that there was something in Master, but he threw his arms around Master, and Master thought, well, let me give him a little taste of what real inebriation is, to be inebriated with God. And so he gave him a touch of bliss, and the man just said, "Say, what are you drinking?" Master said, "I'll tell you this, it has a lot of kick in it." But he left the man sober. Anyway, it was an absolute thrill to be with him. He could be so utterly charming. One of the things that people have not understood is that he had an absolutely wonderful sense of humor. And they have actually cut out, in editing his talks, cut out his own laughter. It's a pity. It was so delightful being with him. Sometimes I would laugh, as I said, with the tears stringing down my cheeks. But they've cut that out. Places in his lectures where he's been humorous, like at his last birthday party, there was a single candle on the cake in front of him, and Dr. Lewis leaned over and he said, "Do you think you can blow that candle out?" Just teasingly. And Master said, "Oh, I think I have a little breath left in me." And then he said something they cut out. He said, "I just have to be careful I don't blow the cake away." But they cut that out thinking it might make some people think he was egotistical. Well, that's a pity, because his humor was so much a part of what he was. Living with him, I remember many times I would be sitting there and just feel this bliss pour over me. It was an understanding of, he was not there to show us how great he was. He came to show us how great we are in our potential. And being with him, you began to see that this is something I can be. I can have that bliss. I can have that great love. He always tried to put it in such a way that we understood that what he had done, we could do. I remember one time I was sitting, I've told you this before too, but well worth repeating, that one time I was sitting at his feet on the floor and he was editing the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita commentaries. And I was just thinking what a wonderful thing it was to be his disciple. And when he finished his work for that moment, he asked me to help him stand. And he stood right in front of me and looked into my eyes. And he said, "Just a bulge of the ocean." He never accepted praise for himself. He never accepted anything for himself. He always directed it toward God. When we touched his feet, he would put his hands like this, quite solemnly, feel it says, to show that he redirected our devotion from him to God. But he was only there to help bring us to God. He told us that story that where Jesus said, "All those who came before me are thieves and robbers." Well, obviously Jesus could not have meant the prophets who went before him, because he said, "I came to fulfill the law and the prophets." But what he meant was, what Jesus meant was, as Master explained, all those who place their egos before me, who accept praise for themselves instead of for God, they are thieves and robbers, because the real devotion and gratitude and reverence and honor should go to God, not to the individual, or the individual channel of that divine blessing. So anyway, his whole life helped to make us aware of truths that I want to read to you now. Is man important in the scheme of things? the professor asked. Man is important in one sense only, the master replied. He was made in the image of God. That is his importance. He is not important for his body, ego, or personality. His constant affirmation of ego consciousness is the source of all his problems. On another occasion, the master told us, man was given ego consciousness to inspire him to seek God. That is the only reason for his existence. Job, friends, personal interests, these things by themselves mean nothing. Now, we, living as we do in this little body, in this little point of space, think that we're terribly important. It's very important to understand God's view of us, because that's the view we should take of ourselves. We don't really matter in the scheme of things, in this sense that you're only like one wave on the great ocean. A wave matters in a sense. It certainly will matter if it overwhelms your boat, but it's a passing thing. And in your human reality, you are a passing thing, a passing phenomenon. You must understand that you are a part of a much, much greater reality. That the things that seem important to you, it's not that God doesn't care for you. Mind you, God takes care of even the little things in your life if you ask him to. I remember just a story that may seem to contradict what I've just said. I remember that one time many years ago, my parents were in Bordeaux in France. I had gone to school in Switzerland, and I remembered Swiss chocolate as being particularly good, and I kept wanting to ask them to send me some Swiss chocolate because they could get it more easily there. I didn't know it was available in this country, but apparently it was. Anyway, I kept forgetting, and just a week before my birthday, I remember saying to Divine Mother, oh, I'm sorry, Divine Mother, I wish I had asked for that chocolate, but now it's too late. We didn't have email in those days. It had to take 2 weeks to get there and so on. So a day before my birthday, I got a package in the mail with a letter saying, I've seen these in a shop, and I wanted you to have them. I was thinking of you. And it was a box of Swiss chocolates. And I thought, Divine Mother has taken care of this little desire of mine, even without my asking her to. But this is, God does care for you on a certain level. He cares for your love, and he plays with you also. There's a beautiful story of a saint in Bengal, Ramprasad. And Ramprasad was out in the yard fixing a fence. And he was singing to the Divine Mother. He was a devotee of the Divine Mother. And he's saying, I keep calling to you, but you never answer. And his daughter came and worked on the fence with him. And she said, well, Daddy, whom are you singing to? And he said, well, I'm singing to the Divine Mother, but she's very naughty. She won't listen to me. She never answers. And the daughter said, well, if she doesn't answer, why do you bother to sing to her? And she laughed and ran away. And later, Ramprasad went in and mentioned to his wife that their daughter had been there helping him with the fence. And the wife said, that's not possible, dear. She's on the other side of town today, playing with some friends. And then he understood it was the Divine Mother who had taken that form. So God plays at hide-and-seek with us. He plays games with us. He loves us, yes, as human beings in a sense, but in another sense, he doesn't mind if we go through suffering. He knows that we have to go through suffering. If you make a mistake, you have to pay for it. He's not going to relieve you of it. You have to learn your lessons. If you can get to that point where you understand that your reality is eternity, then you will find this ego. This is the real stumbling block on the spiritual path. And it's something that couldn't be said until fairly recent times for one reason. That when you see matter as something real, solid, matter can neither be destroyed nor created. And so you think that, well, my ego is substantial. But now that we understand, and science has helped us in this respect, we understand that matter doesn't exist except as energy. We have this body only as a body of energy. It has no reality apart from that. Once we understand ourselves as manifestations of energy, then it becomes easier to understand that we're really manifestations of His consciousness. God didn't create the universe by creating forms like this. He created it from inside. First He made us in thought, then in energy, then in material form. But this material form is only an appearance. You are a wave on the ocean bosom. And so we, as we get into that deeper understanding, it has practical implications for us too. It's like, for example, a violin or a guitar. You need that sounding board. If we had that guitar that you were just listening to, without that sounding board, you wouldn't have heard the strings. Maybe you in the front row would have heard a tiny little plucking sound. But the real power of it fills the hall because of the sounding board. So if we can live with the sounding board of divine power behind us, there is literally nothing we cannot accomplish. Whereas if we think, I'm the one doing it, I can do it all, it's my power that is responsible for everything that I am accomplishing in this world, then what we find also is that we just can't accomplish very much. I remember I used to want to be a writer, and I just couldn't think of anything to write. And I would sit at a page and wait for some inspiration, nothing would come. But after I met Master and he told me that my job in this life was writing along with other things, and I started to write, I found it came to me. I didn't have to figure anything out. By attunement with him, the thoughts just flowed. When I write a song, for example, for another example, I don't have to think, do I want the note to go this way, or that way? I just say, I want a song that says this, this, and this. Give me a melody, and it's there. You'll be amazed if you can understand that God is doing everything through you, and you must do it willingly with Him rather than apart from Him. You'll find that sounding board beneath you, which will give a certain power to everything you try to accomplish. And this means not just doing things like creative work, like writing and composing music and stuff, cooking, all sorts of things, whatever you do, walking down the street, it would be a very good practice to think of God in the second person. Don't think He, think you. And talk to Him all the time. This is a very good spiritual practice. I have found walking down the street and thinking, God, this is, I'm walking with you. You are walking through me. And then you begin to feel that everything is happening around you is something between you and God. It becomes a wonderful symphony with the feeling that even when the dogs bark or in the neighborhood or something, He's saying something to you. You'll be amazed if you have this attitude that He does begin to talk to you. You begin to hear or feel inspirations. There can be inspiration in everything. And most people don't feel inspiration in anything. There is bliss in your nature, but you cut yourself off from it. I remember one time Master had told me to grow a beard. And in those days, no men grew beards. And I was going through the streets of Los Angeles with a beard. People would stare at me. One person called out, Fidel Castro! and anyway, so the people Some people came to me and said, well, would you like to play the part of Jesus at Gethsemane in our installation of officers? So I said, sure, why not? So there I was at Gethsemane. I didn't have to do any acting. All I did was have to sort of kneel by a rock and sigh every now and then. But later, people were saying that I did look like Jesus, and I said to Master, well, I'd rather be like Jesus than look like him. And Master said quite casually, that will come. He always saw us in our divine potential. He didn't think of us as, I mean, I expected him to laugh when he said that. But no, he didn't see me as I am now. He saw me as my potential because he came to show us what we are. We are all equally children of God. Don't think that it's a sign of humility to think that Jesus is greater than you in your soul. You are equal with him in your soul. You must understand what Master said, that to call yourself a sinner is the worst of all possible sins, because it binds you to your sin. You must understand that in yourself you are perfect. I remember when I was giving up smoking, and it was very difficult for me to do. I kept going back to it because I loved that taste of a cigarette when I had my coffee after lunch or something. But every time I went back to smoking, I kept saying, I never said, oh, you failed again, you're no good, what's the use of trying and so on. I always said, I haven't yet succeeded. This is a very good discovery of mine, because in that affirmation of potential success, after a year I gave it up and never thought about it again. So with your sins, whatever they may be, and a sin is only a mistake, it's a mistaken direction. You've thought that you would find happiness this way and it didn't work. Just come back from that. You just made a mistake. In time you will come to correct yourself and realize that this is the right direction to go. We are put in this world, incarnation after incarnation, simply to learn that lesson. Everybody, no matter how steeped in ignorance he might be, the worst mafioso, let's say, everybody is seeking the same basic thing. We have come from God's bliss. Our goal is to merge in that bliss again. Our goal is to become one with God. And so it is that if you will meditate a little bit, try your best. Don't worry about your mistakes. You'll find that if you just keep saying, I haven't yet succeeded, but I will. Always affirm that you are. As Master used to say, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. If you will just keep trying, you will find that instead of laughing at yourself as being so far away from God as to be insignificant, you'll find that you are He, because He is you. Your own nature is bliss, and that's what everybody in the world is seeking. He's seeking himself. It's like that story of the musk deer, that at a certain season in the year, it secretes in a pouch in its navel the odor of the perfume of musk. And it goes madly around seeking the source of this perfume, and sometimes it casts itself from high crags and it crashes to its death in the valley below. And the hunter comes and gathers that musk and sells it for a good price in the marketplace. And if only that musk deer had understood that the fragrance it was seeking was in its own self. The fragrance of bliss that you are seeking is in your own self. But you mistake it. And you think, oh, I'll get it in money, or I'll get it in sex, or I'll get it in power, or in fame. Or you see so many people. I remember this experience I had in Florence, in Italy, a few months ago, where I saw people of all different types, and all of them were seeking many different things, but I could see in this dream that they were all looking for the same bliss. All of them motivated, and this was my reason for loving everybody. Everybody wants the same thing you do. the wonderful thing about this is, if they want your treasure, you want to protect it from them. But this treasure is available inside them. It's available to everybody. So there's no need for jealousy or protectiveness or anything. Rather, you want to help them achieve that. How can you not love people if they really want just that same bliss you do? They will understand someday that that is their goal of life. So the worst mafioso, he may think he wants power, revenge, money, whatever it may be. He doesn't want that. He wants bliss. He just makes a mistake. And he'll get it. He'll find it didn't work. And like Howard Hughes, the richest man in the world, a week before he died, somebody asked him, a reporter asked him, "Are you happy?" He said, "Nah, I can't say I'm happy." Even his tone of voice said it. But if you can understand finally what the right path is, suddenly you find yourself blossoming. Really, it's so simple. The spiritual path, you talk about the tests, and yes, there are tests. No doubt about it, there's that beautiful story of St. Teresa of Avila, who was going in her old age to found a new convent, and her horse slipped in the stream and got pulled down the stream. She fell into the water, and her disciples thought she was being drowned. But suddenly she saw herself on the other, found herself on the other side, completely dry. And Jesus was standing in front of her. And Jesus said, "Don't feel too badly, Teresa. This is how I treat all my friends." And she said, "Oh, my Lord, that is why you have so few." Well, it's true that you will be tested, and you have to show your sincerity. But sooner or later, it really, you look back and you think, what was all the fuss about? It seems so simple and so obvious. All the things that felt so important to you, they just don't matter. And so in that spirit, Master is saying, man is not important in his humanity. Those things don't matter, the things that mean so much to you perhaps today. Someday you'll look back and you think, what was all the fuss about? It's so easy to get overcome. When you've overcome something, you've overcome it forever. You know, there's this wonderful thing that when you break a bone and the bone heals, the bone that forms around that break is stronger than the bone around it. And it's true also that any fault that you have, once you've overcome it, becomes stronger than all the other bone around you, all the other qualities. Many times, your greatest fault will become your greatest virtue once you've overcome it. The doubter will find himself wise. The man of desires will find himself absolutely free from attachment of all kinds. He will live in a sense of deep inner freedom. You will be, sooner or later, it's your destiny. You really don't have a choice, except you do have a choice. You have the choice to delay this destiny for infinitely, or you can do it right now. Most people prefer the first route. And so how long do they keep reincarnating? I read books on reincarnation sometimes, and in these books I find them talking about how some people live even 3 or 4 lives. My dears, it's much more than that. It's a few billion. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about how when God manifests the entire universe, he throws all those souls out that have not been freed before. And you may have to go through days and days of Brahma even, billions upon billions upon billions of years, because it takes 5 to 8 million years for the soul to reach the human level. And that's a constant upward push. But once you reach the human level, then you have the ingenuity to get involved in your own way, and you go up or down. How far down can you go? Well, I don't want to scare you, so I won't say. But sooner or later, you have no other choice, because this is who you are. And always what you are seeking is really a reflection of your own self. When you see something beautiful, I remember this saint in Puri in India saying to me once, "You shouldn't enjoy anything." And I said, "Not even a sunset?" He said, "Nothing." Well, to me, that's a very dry path. My guru had a much better explanation. He said, "Do enjoy the world, but enjoy it with the joy of God." And if you see a beautiful sunset and you feel a rising of joy, don't suppress it. Just say the joy is here, not there. The more you understand it, the more the experiences of this world remind you of who you are inside. In fact, everything you enjoy in this world, you're really only enjoying yourself. Bit by bit, don't feel that you can reach it in a day. It takes time for the body to grow, to become that of a man or a woman. And it takes time before finally you leave this body. It will take you time to get there. But it needn't take time. That's the joke of it. If you really would say, "I have it now," you could have it now, theoretically. Does that theory ever translate into practice? Well, no, I have to admit it doesn't. But it could. It should. If you could say really with absolute conviction, but it's not so easy to get that kind of conviction. Affirmation doesn't do it. You can affirm till you're blue in the face, but if inside there's a voice saying, "Well, you know you're really very imperfect. You know you're just talking through in the air. It sneers at you. But the truth is that you are perfect. And if you will take up the path and spend a little bit of time meditating, first of all, it's important. You know, I remember somebody said to Master one time, "Sir, I don't think I have very good karma, Master." Master replied, "Remember this. It takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. If you look at people in the streets, they don't think of God. Their minds are on money and food and all sorts of other things. But once you've decided that no, nothing is giving me what I want, I need God, then it does take time. Because you still have all, it's like an army invading another country. One part of the army may get ahead, another part may be beaten back. It takes a long time for all your forces to be advancing on one front. So you might find that whereas you become better in one way, you become worse in another. I remember asking Master, "Sir, have I been your disciple for thousands of years?" And he said, "It's been a long time, that's all I'll say." I said, "Well, sir, does it always take that long?" He said, "Oh, yes, desires for name and fame and so on take them away again and again. What happens is you develop a certain spiritual power, a certain spiritual awareness, and suddenly somebody offers you a job, let's say if you'd love to play the piano, and somebody says, "Oh, you could have been a great concert pianist," and suddenly you get stars in your eyes and you try to become a concert pianist. Maybe you succeed. And then what have you got? Endless tours and tiredness and no satisfaction. Everything in the world, nothing works. The amazing thing about this delusion is that it makes so many promises, but it breaks every single one of them. You will never find what you want here. And how many people in their old age are disillusioned? How few go with a sense of gratitude for everything? But the more you try, the more you find just taking banatha banatha banjai, trying a little bit frequently, finally you arrive at the divine goal. So it's really a matter of changing your consciousness. And in what way? Well, to a certain extent, these things are physical. If you can change your level of consciousness, you change your consciousness. It's not just a matter of having to work mentally only, not knowing where you're going. The more you can see your level of consciousness in the spine determines your whole outlook on life. I remember many years ago, I fell into a deep mood, and I tried to reason my way out of it, but the trouble is that reason follows feeling. And the more I tried to reason, the more I saw all the reasons in the world why I was justified in feeling moody. So finally I said, well, reason isn't doing it to me. What do we do, boys? I said to my mental citizens. And they all answered, let's change our level of consciousness. So I sat down and meditated and put my mind here at the point between the eyebrows. All it took was 5 minutes. Once my energy had been raised, my level of consciousness had been changed, I saw everything differently. So don't try to go only by reason. Reason is a very tricky customer. It can tell you all the reasons why you should do what you know you shouldn't do. As a thief will say, well, I mean, if I break into somebody's car, it'll teach him to lock it better and maybe install a security device. So I'm justified in stealing. I'm teaching him a lesson. Well, everybody can find justification through reason. Trust your inner feeling. Everything you do, always refer it back to your heart's feelings. Is this right or is it wrong? Does it help me to go in the right direction or does it force me in the wrong direction? If you can raise your conscience, that's why thinking of God all the time, automatically if you're thinking of God, your mind isn't going to go down to the floor. It's going to go up in your own body. It's not a question of direction outwardly. I mean, for us, what is up is down for the people in Australia. It's a matter of your own body, that which raises your consciousness. This is the story of the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, a great epic in India, which talks about the war between the lower forces in man and the higher. We've all been born with both. How to give emphasis to the higher? The whole battle of Kurukshetra is this war between your own upward aspirations and your downward temptations. The more you can go in the upward direction, the more you find everything you want. That's why Krishna says, and this is a very interesting point to remember, because the mind says, if I get rid of my desire for this or that or the other thing, then I will kill something in myself. But you don't kill anything. You transmute it. That's why Krishna says in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there is no death. The people who die here keep living in other forms. So the very energy that you put into trying to amass wealth and so on, which you may seem an absolute need, once you've transmuted it, it's still there, but it's in a higher octave. All your faults, all your false desires, everything is just a lower octave of expression. Once you can raise that level, then suddenly you find yourself free in Him. So try to direct your energy upward. This is the importance of Kriya Yoga. It brings your energy into the spine. It works with your desire to transmute yourself. For example, whenever you see something that you don't like, you exhale, don't you? When you see something you like, you inhale. These two go side by side. Kriya Yoga helps to bring that in. Now, the physical breath is really an outward expression of your inward reactionary process. The reaction to things that goes... It is positive and negative. In the astral spine, that body you keep after you leave this body, this physical body, in that the breathing takes place in the spine. And with every upward movement, there is an affirmation. With the downward movement, there is a withdrawal. And if you can take that spiritually, withdraw deeper and deeper into yourself until you find the divine self within you. But if you stay on an outward level, it's just liking, disliking, and when you can overcome that, then you achieve that centeredness. Now, when you see a beautiful sunset, for example, or anything that really inspires you, you tend to inhale. There's an upward movement. Now, if you can understand that the joy that you feel in seeing a sunset is really only an upward movement in yourself, a reaction that is positive, and take it inside, not only to the joy of your own being, but to that positive reaction, then you begin to understand what Kriya is about. Kriya takes you into that spine, into that relative positive and negative reaction, and then finally into the deeper self, which leads you toward God. Technique is a necessary part of it, because we're in an outward world where relativity obtains. But the more you can think of God, the more your energy will automatically go upward. When you feel devotion in the heart, don't let it go outward. You'll spill it that way. Turn it inward. Direct it up toward the point between the eyebrows. This, too, is a technique. But it's important that that devotional feeling that you have be directed upward. Otherwise, you'll spill it and lose it and have to start it all over again. The more you can keep your mind directed upward, the more you will find that you fulfill your own desire for fulfillment. So you aren't important as a human being, but you're very important in the eyes of God. And you are as important as Jesus Christ or Buddha or any great enlightened master. You have the same divine in you as they have in them. All they have done is uncover the gold of their own being, which was covered by mud. If you remove that mud, you will find that same gold is in you. God is in you. And that is your importance. Now let me ask if you have any questions to ask. No questions? Yes. Somebody should be up here with me to translate because I'm deaf as a post.
Swamiji, you told the story about the drunken man coming toward Yoganandaji, and I wanted to know, where did that occur, and were you there when that occurred?
What did he say?
The story about the drunken man with Master, where did that occur, and were you with Master?
No, I heard Master tell the story.
I see.
It was before my time. But it was, I think, in a hotel in Minneapolis. I could be wrong. But it was a hotel lobby somewhere.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Back there and then you. First you. Yes. It's my honor to have you here.
Thank you. I have a twofold question. The first question is, in order to diminish one's time for reincarnation, to be reincarnated, and what kind of a life should one choose to live on this planet while one is still alive, besides of loving, compassionate nature and trying to elevate oneself mentally and doing, you know, conducting right action? Is there any other actions that one can take? And my second part of my question
is... Well,
let
me answer this one
yes.
first. Go ahead. What did she say?
She said, in order to diminish the need to reincarnate, other than trying to live a life of compassion and kindness and so on, is there any other kind of life one should choose?
Yes. You must give up desires to come back here. The reason you reincarnate is that you have a longing for the things of this world, and that longing directs the energy. So you're forced to come back here. For example, if you love new cars, there are no cars in heaven. So you'll have to come back here. If you love smoking, they don't smoke in heaven. So you'll have to come back here. So it's very important, if you don't want to incarnate in this world, to give up all attachments and all desires. And many people think that if I give up all the desires and attachments, my life will be empty. I won't enjoy anything. The truth is that you enjoy things much more if you don't depend on them for your happiness, if you can enjoy them with inner freedom. So your next question?
You mentioned yoga and the importance of yoga and raising the energy to the third eye. Well, I don't know too much about yoga yet. And then what is the difference between Kriya Yoga and Kundalini Yoga, or is it the same?
It's all the same, except Kriya Yoga is a specific technique. But their master said Jesus practiced Kriya or a technique very similar. So, mind you, Kriya just means action. And many Kriyas in yoga teachings are... they have nothing to do with our Kriya Yoga. In fact, you have to say, if you're talking of our Kriya, you have to say the Kriya Yoga of Lahiri Mahashay of Benares, because it's a specific kind of technique. But any yoga that works on raising the energy is a kind of Kriya. Okay? And you had a question. If you want to give the mic.
I also thank you for your presence.
It's my joy.
My son and I often have this conversation about all of the religions and the dogmas and the beliefs, and we're always wondering, well, for now, I wonder, how does Ananda or your path distinguish between predestination and free will? I guess that's the easiest way to ask. I know it's a huge subject, but, you know, how much of it is our will that we go to God, and how much is it him, like, how much is dictated to us?
Tell me what she's saying.
How do we distinguish on our path between that which is predestined and that which is by our own will?
Mind you, everything is originally by your will. It isn't that God destines you to be a woman even, or that God destines you to like this thing or that thing. It's you who create this destiny. Yes, there is probably some predisposition in the soul toward the masculine or the feminine, but you can change sexes from one lifetime to another. And there's no way of saying that one sex is better than another. It's like saying that one side of a coin is better than the other. It's impossible. We're equal. But the thing is that you it's not that you're destined to do it. It's by your own actions. So you're predestined, yes, but by your will. Now, free will, it's a very tricky subject. In fact, Master, finally, in trying to discuss it with us, said only the wise really understand the difference. It's too complex to really understand. I found a prophecy written in India during the higher age, Treta Yuga, when it was descending. In this age of energy of Dwapara Yuga, we will overcome the illusion of space. In that one, they overcome the illusion of time. And you know past and future. Master wrote in his poem Samadhi, past, present, all thoughts of all men, past, present, and to come are a part of my awareness. So does this mean that back 5,000 years ago, they would know what color tie a man is going to wear on Monday morning, December 15th? No. He knows every thought that he's going to have. I was astounded when I went to one of these prophecies in India and found that it said that I was born in Romania, grew up in America. My father named me James, which is my first name. That I have brothers but no sister. And if he knew that much about me, I have to assume he knew lots more. But he foretold what would happen, and it came true. And he foretold the difficulties in my life. They came true. Everything he said was right. How could somebody living thousands of years ago know that? Either he was a con or something else. I think it was something else. The thought of who you are, free will, is not a question of being able to do the unexpected. You have the freedom to accept God or reject Him. That's the only freedom you have. At any point on your journey, you have the freedom to turn toward the higher or the lower in yourself. That's the only choice you have. So don't think if I decide I'm going to wear a green tie this morning that it was not possible for anyone to guess it. And you might try a game and say, try to pick up a green tie and suddenly switch to the red. He knows it all. Don't worry about it. Okay? Any other questions? Yes.
This is a personal question, so I hope it's okay. Who are you during the Battle of Kurukshetra? What was your name, and whose side did you fight on?
Who were you during the Battle of Kurukshetra? What was your name, and which side did you fight on?
Okay, actually, he did mention my life in Kurukshetra. He said that I was a ruler of a small kingdom in northern India, probably near Kurukshetra, because he said he was afraid of getting involved in the wrong side. And according to the rules of chivalry in those days, whoever asked you to fight for him, you had to fight for him. So rather than get involved on the wrong side, I gave my throne to my son. And I went out into the forest and took initiation from a guru and went into deep meditation and so on. But it's a very curious thing that you should mention that particular thing, because you could have mentioned many periods of history which I wouldn't know about. But I do happen to know about that one. At any rate, I don't know that I need to get into the details of that life, but it was very interesting. And also it mentioned, you see, all right, I'll tell you. It said he he achieved shanti in his vrittis, which is to say that I must have reached savikalpa samadhi. But at that point, I argued with my guru. I was much too rational, and I got into an argument with him, and he cursed me. He said, you will have to wander until you meet Yogananda. And this is my eighth life since then. And my guru told me that my problem in the past was spiritual doubts. And these doubts, which have certainly been a part of my past, have been like that broken bone, the part that heals. My doubting has made me a good teacher, because I can anticipate everybody's doubts. I understand where they're coming from, and I know the answer to the questions. But it says in the Bhagavad Gita, the doubter is the most miserable of mortals. And my great pain in life has been the desire to help people overcome their doubts and the understanding of what suffering it gives to want the truth and not know how to get at it. Anyway, all of these things tie together. It's very interesting. Okay? What's that?
It didn't give the name. He wanted to know what was the name.
I don't know. He didn't tell me my name. Actually, he may have told me my name, but obviously it would mean nothing to me now. Have you been to the Bhrigu? Sangeeta, it's very interesting. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Yes, thank you, Swamiji. My question, in our path to rise to joy, to achieve bliss, and to raise our consciousness, where does the subconscious mind fit into the picture? There are those who teach that in order to maintain your level of higher consciousness, to maintain your real self, you need to address the hidden beliefs of your subconscious mind. How does that fit into our path to growth and enlightenment?
How does the subconscious mind fit into the path? There are those who say that in order to grow toward enlightenment, you have to address the beliefs or blocks that are in the subconscious mind.
Well, you do, but often you don't have to do it directly. If you concentrate on the positive side, those things will come up. The thing is that if you address the negativity in you, Master used to say that if you try to get rid of darkness with a stick, you won't be able to do it. Turn on the light and the darkness won't exist anymore. And so all those blocks, if instead of thinking of them, you think of the light that you can introduce into them, then they will automatically be changed without your having to enter into that darkness. There are times when it's necessary, but usually the best thing is just to concentrate on the positive aspect. So those people who tell you to go into the subconscious, they're telling you get involved in the mire. It's hard to get involved in the mire and come out clean. Okay? Yes. Yes, in the front here.
Hello? Yes, it's on. I feel like I've tried everything on the spiritual path.
You what?
Feels like he's tried everything on the spiritual path.
Three times.
Three times.
And more, I'm just really taken by Lahiri Mashai's comment in the AY, solve all your problems through Kriya Yoga.
More and more now, he's taken by Lahiri his comment that you can solve everything by Kriya Yoga.
Yes.
Could you comment on that?
Yes, it's not that the technique will solve it. It's that when you raise your consciousness, you find the answer. You know, many times I would go to Master when with a lot of questions in my mind. In his presence, I had the answers. I didn't need to ask the question. And so if you raise your consciousness, then in that raised consciousness, you will know the answer. So Kriya Yoga as a technique will not, but it will raise your consciousness. Instead of trying to figure everything out, practice Kriya. Go deep into meditation. Practice devotion. This is what it means. Then you'll find that in that raised consciousness, you know the answer. It's from your superconscious, finally, that you get the answers, not from reasoning it all out. It's just a clear intuition that comes to you. So if he meant more, I don't see it. I don't see how a mere technique can do it for you. I do see how raising your consciousness can give you that perception. And mind you, this is not an exclusive path. Anybody, whatever path he follows, if he can raise his consciousness, will achieve the same results. So Kriya is a great path, and in some ways it's the greatest because it's the most scientific. But don't feel that it's a sectarian thing. Don't feel that it's exclusive. Everything is taking you in the same direction toward that oneness with God. Okay?
He says, thank you. For him, he feels that raising consciousness and Kriya are the same thing.
You can raise your consciousness without Kriya. That's the difference. You can go into ecstasy as a Catholic monk or a devotee of any religion. And if you've done it, you've done it. And you didn't have to have Kriya to do it. So in that sense, they're different. Only in that sense, you see? Okay? Yes. Yeah? Did you want to ask another question?
No, it's the person next to
me. Oh, the next to me. Okay.
Good morning, Swami Ching. Nice seeing you again. I wanted to know, why did they take away old Master's sense of humor?
Why did they take away all Master's sense of humor?
Because they felt that it was undignified. They felt that they would present him more properly if he was pompous and always serious and always the teacher. He was always the teacher, even in his humor. They themselves don't have that sense of humor. And it used to bother me because I can't help having a sense of humor. But I noticed that this was the case. I couldn't get them to laugh at things. But this is a projection of their own nature. And okay, you don't have to have a sense of humor to find God. But why try to make your guru over in your own image? I think that's a big mistake. We should be trying to appreciate him for what he was in every way. I remember one time this is the only time I was with him and Laurie Pratt, his main editor, Sister Tara at the time, Tara Mata. And he was telling me a story of a time in Ranchi when there were some dogs that he was chasing. He was a very fast runner, but these dogs were bothering the horses and getting in people's way, and Master finally decided he had to take them away and not have them there anymore. So he chased these dogs with a gunny sack, and each dog he put in the gunny sack. And he was telling the story, he was laughing, and I think he was telling the story deliberately because I never knew Tara to tell a joke except maybe an unkind one. And he was laughing till the tears came down his cheeks. In fact, he was talking in such a way that I myself found it hard to understand all of what he was saying. It was, and then like that, you know, just trying to relive the whole thing. And it was absolutely charming, but Tara was sitting there, well, fancy that. And it really told me a lesson. I guess you want to make the guru over in your own image, as I said. I try not to do that because I know that he's far beyond whatever I can understand. I remember her saying to me once, every time I think I've understood him, I find that he's more. Well, I wish he'd pursued that thought further. I've never had the presumption to think I can understand him. I used to pray to him, help me to love you as you love me. And he looked at me one day and he said, how can a little cup hold the whole ocean? You have to become as big as the ocean to absorb that love. So I understood from that I have to become like him to understand him. Well, these are things that I've mentioned, and there they are. Okay? Not much of an explanation, but I can't give you a better one. Any other questions?
Are you a vegetarian? Was your master a vegetarian?
Are you a vegetarian, and was your master a vegetarian?
He was, and I was not. And the moment I read in his autobiography in 1948 that he was a vegetarian, his book had so completely defeated all my defenses, I immediately became a vegetarian. And that same night, I found his book, by the way, just to show you how God takes a hand in our lives. He had sent my father to Egypt to explore for oil there. And the day I put my mother on the ship to go join him was the day I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that book completely transformed my life. And he was a vegetarian, I just immediately gave it up. Never had a desire for it again, but for meat, I mean. And that same night, friends of the family invited me there for dinner, and they gave me chicken a la king. So I pushed the chicken aside and ate the rest, but the day after, somebody else invited me, and they gave me hamburger. I just had to refuse it. So from the day I read that he was a vegetarian, I became one. And a vegetarian, he used to say, proper eatarian is the right term, because some people become fanatics on the subject of vegetarianism. He didn't want us to be fanatics. One time, Dr. Lewis, who was his first disciple in America, he was developing all these pains and aches in his body, and he went to different doctors. Nobody could tell him what the matter was. So finally he asked Master, and Master said, "Your cells are accustomed to eating meat, so eat a little meat once a week, a little lamb, a little fish." And he did, and it went away. But see, Master was very balanced in that respect. But he did recommend to us, at least his third generation disciples, of whom I was a part, that we be vegetarian. And I've been that strictly ever since. Okay? Any other questions? No? Oh, okay.
Good morning, Swamiji. I, in my practice, have really started doing this a couple months ago, and I find that I'm still fighting against falling back in a lot of bad habits spiritually and physically. What do I do when I fall into that, and how can I really avoid doing that in the future?
He started his practice a couple of months ago, and he finds that he's still falling back into bad habits mentally and physically. What can he do to avoid doing that?
Master had a vision of the spiritual path once in which everybody was racing, and he said sometimes they would fall down, but they'd get up and keep going. Yes, you do fall from your practices. This is natural in the beginning, but if you keep getting up and never say, "Well, I've fallen, I give up," always get up, dust off your hands, and try again. You'll find in time that it becomes second nature to do the right things. So don't worry about a fall. Don't worry about, mostly if people slip, they don't fall. But if you just keep never accepting your errors as your own self, then you will find that you become free. There's another little trick. And this is not one to teach safely, but I can tell it a little bit. If you give in slightly, it may take the tension off you so you can try even harder. At any rate, never be disappointed in yourself. Always say, "I haven't yet succeeded." Okay? Well, I guess that's it. Thank you for coming.